Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this morning is Erend Leiphart, political scientist at the University of California, San Diego. And our topic is Two Forms of Democracy. Erend, glad to have you on the show.
Thanks for asking me.
For a number of years, you've been studying various forms of democracy, going back to a book that you wrote in 1984, and I understand you're revising currently. And you've identified what you see as two broad types of democracy or classifications of democracy, what you call plurality or majoritarian democracy and consensus democracy. Could you briefly explain the difference between these two forms of democracy?
Sure. First of all, I think I should probably make clear is that there are a lot of different institutions that democracies use. But as you say that, I find that there are broad patterns as well. So the variety of institutions that democracies use is not infinite. The main difference between majoritarian and consensus systems, if I were to try to sum it up in just a few words, is that in majoritarian democracies, the approach is to try to concentrate political power in the hands of the majority, whereas in consensus democracy, the approach is to try to find as broad and comprehensive agreements as possible.
Okay, could you perhaps give a couple of countries to illustrate this difference.
Right. Another thing I should do too is that these two different approaches really stem from the problem that decisions have to be made, and that it's just very very difficult, of course, to get complete agreement. So what do you do in a situation where you do not have complete agreement? And one answer is to say, let's simply have the majority decide. That at least is better than have a minority making decisions. So in that sense, majority rule is the more democratic way of doing it. The alternative is to say, obviously it should be a majority rather than a minority making the decision, but let's try to make that majority as broad and comprehensive as possible. Now, the specific examples that I would use would be, say, Britain for the majoritarian type and Switzerland for the consensus type. In Britain, power is really concentrated in the cabinet. The cabinet is made up of the leaders of the majority party. The majority party is usually elected by something like 40 to 45% of the voters in Britain, so you have really just a plurality rather than an actual majority. But they are the power holders. Now in Switzerland, it's the other way around. Elections are by proportional representation. You have a multi-party system. The four largest parties form the governing coalition, and this decisions are made only if there is very broad agreement among all of those parties, which also means broad agreement among the Swiss voters who have voted for those parties.
Okay, that's very, very helpful. In trying to think then about ways in which we might shift or change our own democratic government in for a rising democracy, to try to think about the ways, the forms of democracy they would like to institute in their countries, we need to talk a little bit then about the relative merits and demerits of each of those. There's a conventional wisdom that you talk about in your book and in your articles, and the conventional wisdom has it that consensus-type governments, like the ones you mentioned in Switzerland, are very good about providing adequate representation for minorities, sort of generally good on what we might call broadly democratic issues, but that majoritarian governments are much better at making and carrying out policies. They're more effective and they're more stable. Could you briefly explain the appeal of this conventional wisdom, why that looks to be a correct account of the relative merits of the two forms?
Right. The first part of the conventional wisdom is that consensual systems use for the election of legislatures, they use proportional representation, which obviously makes it easier for minorities to get representation, or they can make use of other devices like guaranteed representation for specific minorities. I mean, one example of that is in New Zealand for a long time, there were seats set aside for the Maori minority. So there are also ways of giving minority representation without using proportional representation. But consensual systems, generally, whatever the manner in which they do it, manage to do that better. And I think that is generally acknowledged. The second part of the conventional wisdom is that when you have consensus democracies, the need to or the desire to have as broad an agreement as possible, this involves many more actors than you have if you can just make a narrow majority decisions. And it certainly is true, all other factors being equal, that in any situation, the more people you involve, the more time it takes to make a decision. If a decision can just be made by one person, in all probability, that decision can be made much more quickly and easily than if the agreement has to be made among a larger number of people. And so, for that reason, too, the general assumption is that, for instance, to use the two examples that I used, Britain and Switzerland, that in Britain, where a cabinet consists of one party, it's easier for that cabinet to make the decisions than for the Swiss government to make a decision, because they always have to make compromises among at least these four parties that are represented in the executive.
Okay, so the conventional wisdom seemed to be so strong that many political scientists just never challenged it.
I think that is correct. Okay. I think that's correct.
But I take it that you now do challenge it, that you think that part of the conventional wisdom is correct, that is, that consensus governments do perform better in terms of democratic institutions, but you challenge the second part of the conventional wisdom, that majoritarian governments are more effective and more stable.
That is correct. I challenge it to the extent that I think I'm not making the argument that consensus governments are actually more effective in various policy making areas. I just my argument is that there isn't a great deal of difference between the two, and my argument is based on both kind of arguments that might be called theoretical arguments, or if you look at the logic of the situation, and one could also look at specific policy performance with regard to certain areas. To look at the first things first. I think there are a number of countervailing arguments that have to be looked at. Sure, it's easier for a one-party cabinet to make decisions than for a coalition cabinet to make decisions. But that means primarily that it's just faster to make decisions. And certainly we have examples of that in Britain, when there's a need to change policy. The British cabinets can make those decisions pretty quickly. They have majority support in Parliament, so legislation, if it's needed fast, it can actually be produced fast. My point would be that quick decisions are not necessarily wise decisions, and that the ability to make quick decisions means the ability to make good decisions quickly. It also means the ability to make bad decisions quickly. And I think there's something to be said for restraints on the speed of decision making, because there needs to be a period of debate. All aspects of various issues have to be looked at. And so, of course, in the case of Britain, there are plenty of examples of why, when the decisions are made efficiently, but they turn out not to be very, very effective decisions. One recent example that's been talked about a great deal is the so-called poll tax in Britain, which was imposed by the Thatcher cabinet. It just moved through the cabinet and through Parliament very, very quickly. It is, in retrospect, considered a disaster. And the kind of thing that, if people would have just stopped to think a little bit more carefully, they would never have made. So here's an example of where actually the speed of the decision was a disadvantage.
Okay, and so part of the more theoretical argument for it is that anytime you make a decision quickly, as you put it, you've always got the chance of making a good decision quickly, but you also have an increased chance of making a bad decision quickly. Whereas if it is more consensus-based, if you have to try to bring everyone on board, you have to try to convince a large number of people from different constituencies of the wisdom of the policy, then it's more likely to be a better policy.
Exactly. There are some additional things that could be said that I think are also important, and that is that when you're talking about good decisions, or decisions that are basically good, if they are supported by a bare majority, I think they're less likely to be well implemented or abided by a population at large than a new policy that in fact has wide support among the people. So again, speed may. Have the cost of not having the support, and therefore not having the kind of implementation that is necessary or that is needed. Another aspect of this, and that has often been pointed out about decision making in Britain, is that yes, you can make decisions quickly. When the government changes, these decisions can be unmade very, very quickly too. The government of Britain may look powerful and stable. Over the long run, there is considerable instability in policy. And in the case of Britain, of course, the classic example of that is with regard to nationalization. The Labour government, right after the Second World War, nationalized a number of industries. The Conservatives promised that they would denationalize again. They did so for a number of industries. The Labour government then again nationalized them. This kind of thing obviously could have been avoided if there would have been a broad agreement on say which industry should be nationalized, which should not be nationalized, and if the country could have just stuck with that decision.
Well, let me ask then, that many people in this country complain about endless debates, as they're described on Capitol Hill, that politicians are getting into long and seemingly and debates seemingly without end. They don't seem to go anywhere. Would one implication of your findings then be that some amount of that wrangling, I mean, maybe not all of it, but certainly some amount of that debate and wrangling is not only not a bad thing, it's actually a good thing. It may be a sign of an attempt to build something like a consensus.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. I would say, in the case of the United States, we might well say there's just a little bit too much of that, and it often leads to inaction rather than action that is supported by a broad consensus. But indeed, I think the kind of lengthy discussion which looks to the public at large as being quite conflictual can in many cases lead to some kind of compromise and some kind of consensus. And if it does, I think it's probably you have a better policy than if say a relatively small majority could simply impose its will on the population at large.
I'd like to move and talk a little bit about the idea of democratic performance in a consensus government, but before I do, I'd like to briefly stop and to say that this is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Aaron Leiphardt, political scientist at the University of California, San Diego, and we are discussing two forms of democracy. The part of the conventional wisdom with which you agree, with which you think the evidence supports the conventional wisdom, is the idea that consensus governments are better on factors that might be called factors of democratic performance. And I'd like to briefly ask you to elaborate on a couple of these. For instance, the idea that they are better with representation of minorities. Could you explain why consensus governments are thought to be better at representing minorities?
I think the main reason is that most consensus governments use a form of election that is called proportional representation, which makes it possible for, in principle, let's say there's a 10% of the voters who belong to a particular group, want to be represented by a particular party, that they can elect that particular party, even though they're only 10% of the total population. And that obviously makes it easier for specific minorities to be represented. An example of that is the relatively small Swedish-speaking minority in Finland, which has its own political party, which is called the Swedish People's Party, and has been represented in Parliament for a long time. It's often represented in cabinets as well. And what proportional representation does, and I think which is one of its nice features, is that it allows representation for minorities if minorities feel that they want to be represented by a particular party or by a particular legislator. It doesn't say that if you have a particular ethnic minority, for instance, that they have to be represented by their own party, but it makes it possible for that to be the case. So that is the as I said a little bit earlier, there are other ways to give representation to minorities, and we see examples of that in different countries as well. One additional example I might mention is that in India, for instance, which uses a single member district plurality system, which is also the usual system that is used in the United States for elections, but they have seats that are reserved for the so-called scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. The scheduled castes are just another name for the untouchables. So these are the poorest people in the population, and the political system guarantees that there will be a certain minimum representation by and of the untouchables by reserving specific seats for them. So that's just another way of doing that. What I have done is to try to look at this question broadly for all of the democracies that I've looked at, and try to think, you know, what measure can we use to see how well different countries do with regard to the representation of minorities, because the minorities, of course, in different countries are so different. And what I did is said, well, there's one minority that is just the same in all countries, and that is a minority which is actually, of course, usually a numerical majority, namely women. And I've asked myself, is when you look at the representation of women by women in parliaments in different countries, which countries do better at that. And in fact, it is the consensus democracies that have better representation, have higher proportions of women in their legislatures than majoritarian democracies.
Okay. One of the factors that you mentioned, and I think it ties in with what you just talked about, is that voter turnout tends to be much higher in consensus democracies.
Right. That is, I think, the difference is in the order of magnitude of something like 10 percentage points, but that depends a little bit on which countries you are comparing. But it's quite sizable, and I think voter turnout is important for a number of reasons. All of the democracies, of course, that we're talking about today they're large democracies. Even small countries, say like the small countries in the Caribbean that have populations less than 1 million, they're still representative democracies. And one way in which we can measure whether citizens of democracies are actually interested in being represented and feel that they ought to be represented is to look at participation in elections. So that I think election turnout is one measure of the health of democracies, and we find that consensus democracies in fact do better. One other aspect of this is that the higher turnout tends to be in different countries, the more equal the turnout is. So that one big problem with low voter turnout is that it's socioeconomically biased. It's the more privileged citizens, so people with greater wealth, more income, more education, who turn out to vote more than less privileged citizens. So turnout is also a measure of the equality in the system. And again, the consensus democracies do a better job at stimulating turnout than majoritarian democracies.
Okay, one last feature, perhaps a bit of a surprise maybe to some listeners, is that you talk about consensus democracies having more democratic factors like freedom of the press, freedom of association, and so on, than majoritarian democracies.
I would say that is true only with regard to, I think freedom of the press probably is. I see no big difference. Freedom of association comes in, I think, mainly with regard to the possibilities of political parties to gain meaningful representation.
Okay, we've. What I'd like to do, if we could, in about the last 5 minutes for the show, is to try to see what the implications of your findings are for the understanding of democracy in the United States. So maybe it'd be helpful if you'd first begin and see where you place the United States on this scale. Do you see us as being more majoritarian or more consensus, some sort of blending of the two? How would you describe U.S. government?
Well, the United States is always a difficult case to classify in comparative studies. The first thing that I should just say quickly is that I actually make a distinction between two dimensions, and I've talked so far, and you've asked me so far mainly about the first dimension, which has to do with the question of elections and how governments are formed and so on. The other dimension is the distinction between federal and unitary government. And of course there the United States is a very good example of a federal and decentralized system, and I think one of the important ways in which the U.S. democracy can be a model for other countries is to, especially for the larger countries, that federalism, I think, makes a great deal of sense. Now, returning to the first dimension, I would indeed say the United States is somewhat of a mixture of the two. On the one hand, there are some consensual features in the sense that in order to make decisions at the federal level, you need agreement between the House of Representatives, the Senate, and generally the President as well. So there are three separate bodies that are involved, and that generally means that there's a need for for compromise. On the other hand, there are some majoritarian features in the United States as well. See, like Britain, the United States has a two-party system. There is a great deal of separation of powers. Let's say the legislature has separate powers. The executive in the United States, you know, there's a powerful president, but compared with other countries, the executive is actually not all that strong. I think in Britain, I think the prime minister might be regarded as stronger than the president is in the United States. So there are those features. On the other hand, when you look at executive power, there's a great deal of concentration of power. Namely, it's power is concentrated in just one person, there compared with Britain, the power of the president is greater than that of the prime minister, because the prime minister really has to worry about getting cabinet approval, whereas in the United States the members of the cabinet are basically advisors to the president. So there are clear majoritarian features in the United States as well as in addition to the consensual features.
I know this is difficult maybe for a political scientist to do, but would you have recommendations for ways in which we might change our democracy so that it genuinely does have all the democratic qualities we want with the appropriate amount of stability and effectiveness?
All right. I've actually not been too modest about giving advice or having opinions on the advantages and disadvantages of different forms of government. I've also done quite a bit of writing of the about the advantages and disadvantages of presidential versus parliamentary systems. And my conclusion on the whole is that parliamentary systems work better than in presidential systems. There is just, on the one hand, too much concentration of power. On the other hand, there's often inaction because there's too much of a need to compromise, and that's exactly how I describe the U.S. government. So I would even go so far as to say it would be good for the United States to make the shift to a parliamentary form of government, say like Britain has, many continental European countries have as well. That obviously is a huge change, which I think is. While desirable, I think it's not something that is realistic. I have ideas about minor changes as well. In fact, I just wrote a short article recently, kind of thinking about, you know, how the U.S. House of Representatives could be made a more representative and therefore also more democratic body, and there would be three recommendations that I would make for the House of Representatives. One is election by proportional representation. Oh, that obviously is a pretty big change as well. A second change, which I think would be desirable, is less of a big change. Namely, I think the U.S. House of Representatives ought to be enlarged. I mean, for a big country like the United States, a 435 member representative body is really very small. With each representative just has to represent too many constituents, and I think the size of the U.S. House should probably be increased to something like 650 or so. A third a change that, again, is not as big a change as the others that I've talked about, but I think would be desirable too, is to change the cycle of elections and to make the term for the House of Representatives a four-year term rather than the current two-year term. That would also bring the U.S. more in line with what is usual in other democracies. Something like a four-year term, I think, is about the consensus that the democracies generally follow. Two-year term is just a very, very short term, and I think it encourages too much of a short-term perspective.
Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today. This has been very enlightening.
You're very welcome.
I've been talking today with Aaron Whitehart, political scientist at the University of California, San Diego. This is Eula Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.